The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last few times I've been talking about things that are added to our experience that create struggle, suffering, stress. And so much of these things that are added, I spent 1 week talking about ways that reactivity is kind of an addition to our experience. We have experienced something pleasant, we like it, we want more of it, we feel like having it is what will bring us happiness. We don't like something. We want to push it away. We want to get rid of it. We want to fix it, change it. We feel like getting rid of it or somehow changing it so that it's no longer unpleasant or so that we're no longer in the experience of that unpleasant. Either get the thing away from me or get me away from that thing. And we think that that will bring us happiness. So that's one way, one kind of set of additions to our experience that I was talking in the guided meditation about, just simply knowing the experience of being a human. And it's actually quite simple. Joseph Goldstein sometimes says, there's only 6 things happening in our human experience. There's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and things happening in the mind. And so beginning to recognize that flow of experience, and that some of those things are pleasant, some of those things are unpleasant, some of those things are neutral. And yet we so often add on to that this kind of reactivity. And yet that reactivity too is a very natural human experience. And so we too can know that. And we begin to recognize that wanting something, trying to hold on to something, it actually hurts. That's the suffering that the Buddha was exploring, this possibility of being free from. Wanting to get rid of something, fix something, change something, the pushing away piece of it. I mean, there can be a kind of very natural discernment around certain experiences, we don't continue holding on to a hot pot on the stove, right? Just because, unpleasant. No, we let it go. So, there's a very natural movement of the body to release, move away from unpleasant experience, and yet there's often additional reactivity around that. And so this movement of reactivity, when we start to look at that pushing away, I mean, there's a difference between holding on to the pot and then hating the fact that it's burning and then being really angry and throwing the pot across the room, or just having the mind, having the hand release the pot. That kind of release, that movement of releasing a hot pot is a natural movement of the body taking care of itself out of not wishing to be harmed. That's a movement of compassion. And so the movement to respond to the world can come not from desire, greed, or aversion, but from kindness, from generosity, from love, from compassion, from wisdom, from equanimity even. And so this is one way that we add things, this reactivity. And last time I talked about another way we add things through views, ideas, beliefs, opinions, agendas. This is a lot of where so much struggle and suffering comes from in our lives. We have views about who we are, what we can do, what we're capable of. And these views kind of can limit us. We hold on to certain perspectives about other people. And those views also create a limitation in our mind for them. And I went through so many different kinds of views the last time I talked, so I don't want to repeat that, revise that. But I will remind you one thing that's so interesting about views. You know, I'm talking about what we add, or what is added to our experience. And the way views often work is that we haven't chosen to add them to our experience much of the time. They come with our conditioning, these views of how we think things should be, from our families, from our cultures, from our friends, from our school, from radio and advertisements, from the internet. Our views are formed by what we take in. And so it's almost not so much that we add the views, but that they have been added to us through conditioning. And so the fortunate thing is that we don't have to be beholden to those views. One of the big issues around views is that they're often, partly because they come in through this backdoor channel of our culture, our families, our friends, we're not so conscious of them. We're not so aware that they are views. We think it's just how things are. We think that our views are about the world, our views, I think I mentioned the last time, things, you know, we have views about how close you stand to somebody when you talk to them. We have views about how much eye contact you make, whether you touch somebody that you know or don't know. All of these views, they're not, it's not like somebody sits you down and says this, right? Here's how far you stand from somebody. It's absorbed through just being in our culture. And so these kinds of views are particularly tenacious because they're not so intellectual. They kind of get absorbed through our body, our system, our being. And yet, it is possible to begin to recognize. Often when views are challenged, you know, you go visit another culture, you'll see so many views about what it is to live in community, live in a culture, that are challenged. It's one of the things I love about travel, to really, oh, right, that's a view. That's a constructed view. It's a societal or cultural view. And so we can begin to recognize that views are there. We begin to recognize views. And the way views tend to create problems in our, or create suffering, let's say, not so much problems, create suffering, struggle, stress, unease, is when, partly when they are unseen, unrecognized as views, and we hold to them and try to apply them and hold other people to those views. And other people holding their own views. You know, this is so much of where war comes from. Holding to views. Views about what people should believe. Views about what people have rights to. And so this area of views, really useful to begin to make it conscious, begin to recognize, oh, this is a view. So views themselves are not inherently a problem. And we need to navigate the world with views. It's like part of our human system. Views about how close you stand. Simple views like that. I mean, there's so many complex views that we hold about culture, about society. You know, those kinds of views just help us to be in relationship. And so the views themselves aren't inherently problematic, but when we hold to them as being true, or and they are unseen, or even if they are seen and are believed as truth, this is where there can end up being conflict. One quote I love, I think I mentioned this last time, from one of my favorite texts in the Sutta Nipata. Those attached to views roam the world offending people. This is one of the key places where the Buddha said conflict arises when people cling to views. So it's not the views themselves, he said, are problematic. Certain views can be problematic, but you know, just many of the views we hold are not inherently problematic until we cling to them, until we believe them to be truth. Often, these views that we hold are merely alternative perspectives on the world. And beginning to recognize that is very helpful. Some of these views do reflect some more human, perhaps, understanding of ethics. You know, the views around non-harming. You know, that people have, that it's not skillful, it's not useful to a view, perhaps, that it's not helpful to harm people or oppress them. And so what happens if the view is true like that, has a kind of a truth in that way? Again, you know, it's so helpful to recognize the difference between the view and the clinging to that view. In the clinging to a view, we can be navigating the world with anger and hostility when we see that that view, you know, the view of the view of it not being, you know, the view that it's wrong to oppress people just because of their skin color in subtle ways or obvious ways. You know, I hold a perspective that that is right. And yet, I hold it, I hope. I mean, my aim is to hold it and hope to not close people out of my heart when I see that they're holding another view. And to hopefully respond in a way from compassion rather than hatred. So this becoming aware of views can help us to navigate the world with a little bit more of an open heart. And yet not with a resignation, you know, not saying, oh, you know, like, oh, burning with your hand on the stove, but this is suffering. This oppression is suffering. The heart that's open, that's not contracted, wants to act to alleviate that suffering, to find a way to support moving away from suffering. And this is really the, you know, the perspective that the Buddha offered us. This is where it brings me to this question. You know, here I'm suggesting that views, when clung to, create suffering. And so what is wise view about? Wise views, the very place the Noble Eightfold Path begins. What is this about? How do we relate to wise view? The wise view the Buddha offers is a view or a perspective around suffering. It's a perspective about, from his understanding, how suffering is created in our experience, how suffering is created in interaction with others. And his perspective was, I want to find out if it's possible for human beings to be free from suffering, from struggle, from unease. And so this was his aim. His aim wasn't, I want to see how much money I can get or how much I can have people respect me. But is it possible to be free from suffering? And so the view that he offers us is, my understanding is, the view he offers us around suffering is an articulation of something he understood directly in his own mind and his own experience. And he suggests that it's useful to use this view, explore from this perspective, and see for yourself, does it support you in becoming more free from suffering? So it's offered as a perspective to explore, not as a perspective to cling to, not as a perspective to go fight wars over, to say, this, only this is true, nothing else is true. Everything else is wrong. So many wars have been fought from that perspective. So much conflict comes. Only this is true. Everything else is wrong. Even about his own teaching, he said, I don't hold anything with that perspective. Only this is true. Everything else is wrong. And yet, this is a useful perspective to adopt. Explore for yourself. And much of what I talked about in terms of the ways that we add struggle, this is embedded in the teaching on wise view. There is a way that we add to experience, to this human experience, that creates our struggle, our suffering. The addition of reactivity, the addition of holding to views, in particular those two that I've been talking about these past weeks. The whole of the framework of wise view is centered around what supports us to let go of the ways that we add suffering to our experience, and what supports us to move towards those ways that release us from suffering, release us from that. Oh, suffering, you know, this word dukkha, this word suffering is so many, it's translated as suffering, dukkha, this word dukkha. It's got a wide range of meanings, and in experience, you know, suffering often is a pretty big word in the English language. We think of it meaning huge things, big suffering. But this word dukkha is a very broad meaning. It can refer to the subtlest unease, a sense of, it's not the way I like it. A little bit of contraction about, don't want it that way. To the more major sufferings in our lives. The loss of family or friends. Illness. This whole range of what dukkha is. The whole teaching is centered around the possibility of being free from the struggles around the human condition. Being free from dukkha doesn't mean that we're free from family members dying, friends becoming very ill, ourselves becoming ill. Doesn't mean that. But it means the heart can be rest at peace in the middle of what's here, what's already here. And that resting at peace is a lot about not clinging to views, not clinging to wanting things to be other than they have come to be, than they already are. And this is a lot of the practice we explore. Oh, this, what's here? What has already come to be? That can't be changed. It's already here. And so much we are actually resisting and fighting what is already here, spending so much of our energy fighting what's already here. And that energy is not then available to be used in a more skillful way to respond with compassion, generosity, kindness. And so again, it's not about not acting in the world. You know, something that has come to be, what's already here can't be changed, and then there's some measure of how do we respond to that? Do we react with hatred or confusion or aversion? Or do we meet it with wisdom, with compassion, with generosity, and step forward in the next moment motivated by those qualities? Acting from wisdom and compassion rather than greed, aversion, delusion. And so the clinging to wanting things to be other than they are, this the Buddha pointed to as a key. It's a key for us. And it's a challenge. It's very deeply enmeshed in our perspective. From the times the moment we're born, you know, we don't come into the world born with views about how far people stand from each other, but we do come into the world with some measure of the organism wanting to find ease in its surroundings. And, you know, hunger is experienced, and crying generates the relief from that hunger when mom comes to feed you. And the patterns of that very human condition begin to generate, you know, it's like hunger, don't like it, cry. And I'm not suggesting, you know, just, you know, gonna like, you know, make sure this isn't misunderstood. You know, cry, get food. Ah, that feels good. That over and over again, even from the time we're born, we get the sense of, ah, get something that takes the unpleasant away. That feels good. Get something that keeps the pleasant here. That feels good. And our perspective around that's the way to happiness is born out of this very simple human condition. Get something I want. That's the way for happiness to be there. Get rid of something I don't want. That's the way for happiness to be there. It's very human. It's not a view that our cultures teach us. It's a view that our body teaches us. But it is a view. It is a view. And the view that it is the only way to happiness is a deep misunderstanding. And we apply that to things beyond hunger. You know, I'm not suggesting that you stop eating here just because it's unpleasant. You know, that's not helpful either. That's something the Buddha discovered. You know, he did all of these ascetic practices and got, you know, he thought, you know, that those were some of the teachings in his day. Some of the view in his day was you starve yourself enough that your soul wants to be liberated from the body. And so he perfected this starvation practice. He got to the point where it said he could feel his spine when he touched his belly. He was so emaciated. His hair was falling out. And at some point he recognized, this is not the way, and began eating again. So, you know, even that, we can cling to the view, this is the way, starvation, that will allow my mind to be liberated from the body. That was clinging to a view. And so I'm not suggesting that we not take care of our bodies. And yet this mechanism that is so deeply ingrained from the time we're born is applied to so many things. And we think that happiness comes from continually stringing together pleasant moments, including getting rid of unpleasant moments. And what the Buddha discovered was this releasing from the craving for that. There was a deeper kind of peace that was possible there. And this is the wise view he offers. In a very succinct way, he said, so the wise view is expressed in many ways in the teaching of the Buddha. One way is through the statement of the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, and suffering should be understood. There is a cause or origin of suffering, craving, that should be released. There is a possibility for knowing freedom from suffering, and that should be realized. And there's a path leading to this freedom, and that should be cultivated. The statement of the Four Noble Truths being one of the most foundational ways that wise view is understood. What leads to suffering? What leads away from suffering? At one point, somebody came to the Buddha and asked him to express his teachings very succinctly. And the Buddha expressed it this way one time. Nothing should be clung to as I, me, or mine. Even views, even wise view, nothing should be clung to as I or me or mine. And yet, again, as I said, adopting this perspective of wise view, we may cling to it, you know, and initially, at least what I've seen in my own practice is, you know, I may cling to this view somewhat around, okay, yeah, I need to be present for my experience. This is helpful. You know, so there's some wisdom there, but there's also a little bit of like, no, I need to do this. And that perspective has offered a way to begin to both recognize other views around, I have to get this thing that I want. Oh, how about being mindful of it? What happens? I have to get rid of this thing that I don't want, this unpleasant thing. How about being mindful of unpleasant? What happens? So holding this view helps to kind of reveal and help us let go of views, perspectives that have added suffering to the world, added suffering to our experience. And yet at some point, so it's kind of like it lets us let go of these more, these views that have been given to us both from the time we were born and by our culture, they begin to be revealed through this perspective of wise view. So to some extent, we're adopting a conscious view rather than having it like come in through the back door. It's like, okay, let's try this one. So adopting a conscious view that allows us to see the way some of these other views have led to suffering, have led to confusion, have led to pain in our own experience and in our world. And so we see this. Oh, this is useful. And we may start to even more, yes, really need to do this. At some point, you know, we end up feeling the suffering of holding on to that view. Because, you know, our minds are, well, let's say our minds have their own mind, their own, you know, we cannot control our minds in the way we'd like to. We hold this view, we know it's a good perspective in terms of letting go of suffering, and we start thinking, maybe even from the beginning, we thought, I should be able to keep my mind here in the present moment. Good luck. And yet, we can begin to incline in that direction. So at some point, we begin to see if we're holding on to, I should be able to do this practice, I should be able to not have unwholesome mind states that lead me to suffer. I should be able to turn off aversion when it's happening. Clinging to that view and that perspective, you will suffer. And so at some point, clinging to views, clinging to even wise view, begins to reveal itself as, oh, that's not so helpful either. And so we may begin to be able to adopt this perspective of, this is useful to hold to, or useful to use as a perspective, but not useful to hold to, not useful to cling to. There's a couple of teachings in the suttas that I really like around this perspective of using views, but not clinging to them, and how using views like this can actually help us to ultimately let go. One is the simile. Simile of the raft. And in this teaching, the Buddha says that, you know, if you're on a shore, a near shore, and you see the danger in the near shore, you know, there's people coming after you, there's, you know, disease and pain and all kinds of trouble on this side of the shore, and you see this big expanse of water, and over on the other side, you see a shore on the other side that you have a sense there's peace over there. And so you look around you, and what is there? There's twigs and branches and mud and things that you can gather together and build a raft out of. And making that effort to build the raft, you can cross over the water. You know, staying, you know, making the effort as you cross to paddle, to make effort with your hands and feet to cross over the water to reach the other side. I love several things about this analogy. First, that the raft is created from the simple things that are around us. It's not that we build this amazing boat. You know, we build a raft out of sticks and stones. That's good enough. We build a raft out of our experience. And this is, in a way, an analogy for the Eightfold Path, meeting our human experience, meeting these six areas of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the things happening in our mind. So using the Eightfold Path to meet our experience, using that view, using wise view to create this raft, making the effort to cross, making, you know, paddling, you know, it's like, the other thing I like about this analogy, especially with the image of a raft like that, you know, this makeshift raft. It's said in the analogy that the water represents the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion that we're crossing over. And this raft, this image, at least for me, evokes, you are going to get wet when you cross over the water. You are going to be in contact with suffering as you cross over. It's not that we somehow get, you know, float across the greed, aversion, and delusion. We transcend, we transform greed, aversion, and delusion through meeting it with this practice, this wise view. And a lot of the exploration is around, what is the human experience of greed? Not, oh, this is greed, how do I get rid of it? Oh, greed too, this can be known. What's the human experience of aversion? Ooh, pushing away. In this very recognition with mindfulness, instead of, Well, there's a huge difference, between knowing aversion as a human experience. Oh, this is what it's like for a human to be, to be experiencing aversion. And between acting on that aversion in order to get rid of something or fix something or change something or flee. Huge difference between those two. One buys into the aversion as the way to happiness. The other is using this perspective of wise view. What wisdom can be learned from watching this aversion? So we make this effort. We meet our experience crossing over. And then the Buddha says, once you've reached the other side, would it be a useful thing, would it be helpful to pick up that raft and say, wow, this raft has been really useful to me. Let me carry it around on my head while I walk about on dry land. Would that be helpful? His monk said, no, that wouldn't be helpful. So it would be more useful to let the raft go adrift down the stream or to set it on dry land and go about your business. So even that teaching, even that raft should not be clung to. The very thing that helped us to cross over. He said, the teachings of the Dharma are not to be clung to. And yet, you know, again, this analogy, I love this analogy because it, again, points to you're in the middle of the river. You know, you're in the middle of the river. You're working to cross the river. Not so helpful to let go of the raft there. You know, maybe we have to cling to the raft for a little bit while we're crossing over. Maybe we recognize it's hard. And we see how it's helping us to cross over. And yet, getting to the other side, not so helpful to keep holding on to it. The other teaching I love is a direct teaching about views. This one I really love because it didn't come out of the mouth of the Buddha. It came out of the mouth of one of the Buddha's lay followers, a householder, a person who was not a monastic. He was a very wise lay person, and he loved the Dharma, loved the practice. His name was Anandapindika. And he had a lot of conversations with people. He loved being in Dharma conversation, and people also came to him. And at one point, a bunch of people from other sects came to talk to Anandapindika, and they said, tell us, householder. That was typically the word given to somebody who was not a monastic or an ascetic. Tell us, householder, what views the contemplative Gautama holds. Gautama is the given name of the Buddha, the family name of the Buddha. Tell us, householders, what views the contemplative Gautama has. And Anandapindika, being very careful in his speech, says, Venerable Sir, I don't know entirely what views the contemplative Gautama holds, the Blessed One has. And they seem a little bit haughty in their response. Well, well, so you don't know what views the contemplative Gautama has. So tell us what views the monks have. He responds again, I don't know those views either. Can't really tell you what their views are. Say, oh, so, okay, well, maybe you could tell us what your views are then. He says, well, I can tell you my views, but first I'd like to hear your views. And so they tell him. And they have a number of views that are in direct contradiction to each other. So things like, and these are what we could call spiritual views or views about reality. These are the views that were being held as views that would lead to freedom. And one of them said, the cosmos is eternal. Only this is true. Everything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I have. Another said, the cosmos is not eternal. Only this is true. Everything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I have. And many, many metaphysical views that they had about cosmos is finite, the cosmos is infinite, the soul and body are the same, the soul is one thing, the body is another, things like that. And the way, and they, you know, it's interesting, they ended up having a lot of arguments with each other. That was a lot of what happened. There was debate about what view was right. And many of these views actually, and this is something the Buddha actually warns us about, many of these views come out of meditation experience. A view of the vastness of the cosmos. It's possible, you know, times when the mind lets go of the human body, the sense of the body, and there's a sense of the vastness of the cosmos. And So, that coming out of these deeper meditation experiences, one can easily create a view. I've experienced for myself, this is what is true. And so they would be arguing about their experience. You know, this is what I experienced, and this is true. So the cosmos is infinite. The cosmos is finite. The one saying the cosmos is infinite is saying you just haven't seen far enough. You know, that you're limited, your perspective is limited. The other one says, no, I've seen that sense that the cosmos is finite, but I've seen beyond that, and actually beyond that sense of infiniteness, it really is finite. It really is. It really is finite. Okay. They can each, you know, one up the other from their meditation experience. So the Buddha actually cautions us about views that are created out of our meditation experience. I think this is a really interesting thing to reflect on. So back to Anandapindika and the wanderers. So Anandapindika said, you know, when you hold views and hold them tightly like this, as for the one who says, the cosmos is eternal, only this is true, anything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I have. The view arises from inappropriate attention, meditation experience, attending to meditation experience, perhaps in a different, in an inappropriate way, or independence on the words of another. So speaking to two main ways that views come, based on our own experience and our views about that, based on what other people say to us. Now, this view has been brought into being. It's fabricated, dependently originated. So it's conditioned. This view is conditioned in dependence on our own attention or on what other people say. Whatever has been brought into being, whatever is conditioned is inconstant, is unreliable, it's impermanent. What is unreliable is stressful when held to. Thus, the Venerable One is adhering to his own stress. When this had been said, and Anandapindika said this for all the views, you know, this is, you're basically creating suffering for yourself, holding to this view. And so they said to Anandapindika, well, tell us what views you have then. Anandapindika says, whatever is brought into being is constructed, dependently originated. Whatever's conditioned. This is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stress. Whatever is stress is not me, not what I am, is not myself. This is the sort of view I have. And they tried the same argument on him. Oh, you're holding to that view. That is your stress right there. And Anandapindika says, with whatever's been brought into being, including the sense of a view, I recognize it as inconstant, unreliable, and am released from the suffering of it right there. Having seen this well with right discernment as it is actually present, I also discern the higher escape from it as it is actually present. And so this speaks to this kind of view. Nothing is to be clung to as I or me or mine, even views. The recognition that views too are inconstant, unreliable, fabricated. Holding to something unreliable, impermanent, will create suffering. This view can lead us to recognizing that even that view should not be held to. So it's a, in a way, it's a view, a perspective. Wise view is a perspective that allows us to transcend even clinging to that view. And there's also this kind of understanding or recognition we have to start somewhere with wise view, with wisdom. And at first, it's the adoption of a perspective, a conscious recognition. Oh, yes, this is useful. This helps. We apply the tools. And so initially, it's kind of like we take it on faith. You know, somebody said this is useful. We think about it. We reflect on it. Maybe it'll be useful. Well, nothing else I've tried has worked. Maybe I'll try this one. We have a sense of being willing to engage with the teachings. And with that engagement with the teachings, it's not that intellectual beliefs are confirmed. It's more that the experience of the release of suffering is directly known. And so it's not about adopting a view to hold it in our minds. It's the holding the perspective to begin to recognize where does freedom lie? Where does release from suffering lie? The experience of it. It's a different way of seeing, in effect. So wise view is a quote from a scholar. When the texts teach that one should strive to attain right view, they are suggesting the attainment of a specific attitude, a way of apprehending things without any form of attachment. Right view is not simply another view as opposed to wrong view, nor is it the rejection of all views. The opposite of wrong view is of a different nature, not a mere correction intellectually, but a different order of seeing. So the perspective of wise view allows this meeting of experience, the direct experience of seeing, oh, this is suffering. This is suffering releasing. And how one moves from one to the other, how one opens to crossing that stream, getting wet, seeing the human experience of greed, aversion, and delusion, and feeling, even in the midst of feeling aversion, perhaps, one of that turning with the perspective of, oh, this is a human experience of aversion. There's a shift of that. It's not I or me or mine in that moment. This is the human experience. This is nature. My aversion creates struggle, stress, beliefs about the aversion and what needs to happen. Oh, turning with that perspective of, oh, this is the human experience. It can create a kind of a sense of space almost. Even in the midst of knowing aversion is present, there can be a feeling of release from the clinging to, this is a problem, I've got to fix it. this is the experience. What's a skillful response? Very different. Very different perspectives on that. So, I've talked, but there's 2 minutes left. Time maybe for one question or comment, if there's anything. Yeah, would you use the mic?
Dukkha, there's a range of dukkha, and you said even though your mom or your friend is dying, you can be at peace. You didn't say your mom, your family or your friends or dying or dead. You could be at peace in your heart. How do you do that?
The practice unfolds through recognizing, a lot, at least in my experience, unfolds through recognizing the ways we are not at peace, the ways that we resist the truth. So much of our pain around around the death of a family member or a friend has to do with the fact that we are resisting that this is happening, that this is the truth. And so it's what we explore with this practice is beginning to open to what the truth is. You know, beings die. This is nature. And so there is a heart that is, you know, the heart that's constricted around that feels a lot of pain with that. And the first place of exploration is opening to, yeah, there is this constriction. This too is a human experience, this constriction. And over time, the heart begins to recognize that that constriction is extra. Maybe every now and then the mind kind of opens to, right, this is the way it is. My mom is dying. And there's the heart that stops being so hard and tight. And there's a feeling in the heart there. Ease and peace doesn't mean that we don't know loss, that we don't know sadness. There's a way in my experience that sadness can feel very pure. It's just like pouring through. It's not constricted and fighting with anything here. It's just this sadness. The heart can be at ease with that sadness. So it maybe has a different flavor than what we think of as peace when we hear the word. So a lot, I think, has to do with just recognizing the constriction and exploring that's crossing the flood. What is this experience of the heart that's resisting this truth? This is what it is. This is how it feels. This is what hurts. And unfortunately, we do need to stop. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards. So thank you.